This is Ukraine calling.
Okay, so this is the second issue of the Ukraine calling relaunched. I'm Andrei Kulikov. I will be presenting this show, and our guest today is Andreas Umland. He is the analyst of the Stockholm Center for Eastern European Studies, and one of the people whose tweets and whose telegram I read constantly. And even today I got at least two messages from Andreas, obviously not addressed directly to me, but to his rather big audience on Telegram. One of them is about the statement by the Amnesty International. It is the comment on what he calls the infamous Amnesty International report about the behavior of Ukraine's military. And another one which came a bit earlier is stories about Ukrainian Nazis were rare before 2014 when they surged at the moment when Russia's plan. Andreas has been in Ukraine, and I think for Ukraine, even before 2014. But my first question to you is, what are you witnessing changing in Ukraine since 2014 and in the world's attitude towards Ukraine?
I think the major change has actually happened not in 2014, but in 2022, 5 months or almost 6 months ago, when this large invasion happened. There was already a spark of interest in 2014. But since 2022, since 24th of February, the attention has dramatically risen to Ukraine. And now you can, in Germany and in many other European cities, see Ukrainian flags everywhere. And Ukraine is in mass media every day. And there are all these organizations now that present themselves. So suddenly now Ukraine is on the map of most people. And unfortunately, it needed to take this large invasion by Russia to happen, for that to happen. The 2014 annexation and this start of this, I call it pseudo-civil war in Donbas, was not enough. So back then, there was a certain change as well in the international perception of Ukraine, but that was only for a few months and more spark. But now I think that is a more fundamental change, and in a very odd way, Putin has now integrated Ukraine into Europe.
Andreas Umland, you've been watching the situation, or I would rather say you've been influencing the situation in Ukraine and around Ukraine for many, many years. And now with the resurged or flared up attention to Ukraine, do you find it easier or harder to explain things in our country and around our country?
Well, it has become much easier now because the flow of information is enormous, and the illusions about Russia are now largely gone. There are still some people who are trying to defend or explain Russian behavior, but the discussions we had until early this year, 2022, about how to find, for instance, a solution for the Donbas, about the Minsk agreements. These discussions have largely gone, and it has now become easier to explain Ukraine. The problem is rather now the discussion about the best strategy vis-a-vis Russia. And unfortunately, there is still a division within the West, in that some people think that it would be less risky for the West to not help Ukraine that much and to not sanction Russia that much, because that would presumably escalate the situation, and that such an escalation is bad for the West. And now the main problem is plain and simple fear on the side of many people in the West who fear World War III, who fear nuclear war, and the Kremlin is, of course, playing with this fear. and is trying to exert pressure. So to put it in sort of more general terms, one could say that the main problem before 24th of February was Russia's soft power that was successful to a degree. Now it's largely Russian hard power that is generating this sort of hesitant approach from the West towards Ukraine.
Of course, a whole gamut of questions arises from what Andreas Sumlund, a analyst at the Stockholm Center for Eastern European Studies, has just told us. I'll try to go on with the issue of the Third World War. Several months before the Russian invasion, the full-scale invasion, I mean, I got a present from a friend in Canada who sent me a novel called 2036. And this is a novel about the Third World War, co-authored by Admiral Stavridis. And the world war begins there in southern China Sea. Of course, we now see the flaring up of tensions between China and Taiwan. But in that novel, Ukraine is almost never mentioned. Why do you think there was such a misconception that Ukraine doesn't matter? Or am I wrong in this? The conception was there, but maybe not spoken about.
Well, one could actually argue that perhaps Ukraine and the Ukraine issue is indeed overestimated in that we are not actually here on the brink of World War III between Russia and the West, because Russia does not want World War III, and it's too weak to conduct such a world war, whereas maybe China may in 2036 feel strong enough to go to war with the US. So actually, you know, I would rather support this sort of view of the issue, in that we, for instance, seen what happened in 2015 when a NATO country, Turkey, shot down a Russian airplane over Syria. And according to normal Russian military doctrine, that would have demanded an adequate counterstrike, sort of an answer, shooting at least a Turkish airplane down, perhaps even destroying a Turkish airport in response to this shooting down of a Russian airplane. But nothing like that has happened. And I think the reason is that Turkey is a member of NATO and that Russia does not want this world war. And it's now talking a lot about it quite purposefully. And it's trying to threaten the West not only with a world war, but also with an energy crisis, also with this idea of a Russian-Chinese alliance. But I don't believe all of that. I don't think that Russia has actually that much leverage, and that Russia is constantly sort of trying to look scarier than it is.
I am a bit surprised, although you have started to explain this, that you said that Russia fears that they may not win the world war, because the entire rhetoric of Russia is we are the strongest, we have the right to at least influence the entire politics all over the globe. And this psychological pressure, I think, really influences many people, in Ukraine including. As an analyst, as a person who's been watching and influencing the state of affairs for many, many years, how do you counteract this psychological pressure? I'm pretty sure that you are one of the objects of Russian pressure as well. I've read articles.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just one of many who is in the field. And what I'm usually trying to talk about is the immediate threats that the Russian behavior is already creating currently for the West. And here, one could mention the most obvious thing now with the grain exports and with the possible hunger in Africa and in Asia, and then the repercussions this then may have for political stability in Asia, and Africa, and also for new immigration pressure for the EU, or the subversion by Russia of the logic of the non-proliferation regime, the regime for the prevention of the spread of nuclear weapons, because Russia is obviously behaving the way it behaves because it has nuclear weapons. Ukraine has no nuclear weapons, and the odd and actually very risky side aspect of this is that Russia is explicitly allowed to have nuclear weapons and Ukraine is explicitly forbidden to have nuclear weapons by the non-proliferation treaty that both of these countries have signed. And Russia's behavior obviously undermines the logic of this treaty because it suggests to all countries around the world that you cannot count on security, and if you are not part of an alliance, if you don't have nuclear weapons yourself, or you are not part of an alliance which has nuclear weapons. And so it may be very suggestive, not only for the West, for many countries around the world, that now this that Russia is basically employing this this treaty that is supposed to prevent the nuclear spread of nuclear weapons for its war against Ukraine, and that then this entire regime becomes undermined, and that can have grave repercussions. At least once, let's say, in a future technological future that I cannot know yet, it may be easy to produce nuclear weapons. Currently, it's not so easy to produce a nuclear weapon, but who knows? In 10 years, maybe it may be much easier to produce a nuclear weapon. And then the current conflict and the hesitant help to Ukraine by many countries around the world, or let's say the behavior of China, which is also an official nuclear weapon state, may then suggest to many countries to actually get a nuclear weapon to protect itself or to expand its territory. Or one could mention the Ukrainian nuclear power plants and other such. So I'm trying to talk about these things that have direct repercussions for Western security and that are much more tangible than this threat of World War III.
The threat of World War III and of nuclear war, you know, I've been growing in the times when nuclear war was one of the word combinations that sounded every day, resonated in our minds, and we were immensely happy almost every day because it wasn't happening. And then detente came, and then another aggravation, then cruise missiles and a neutron bomb and all this kind of stuff. But still, it has not happened. So is nuclear war a what we used to call a scarecrow, or does it have a chance to become a reality?
I think it is largely a scarecrow, or it's used this way by Russia now. And we should also remember, I'm also old enough to remember these times when in the Cold War we were afraid of this. What we should also remember is that there were many more nuclear weapons back in the Cold War than now, because the arsenals have gone dramatically down. There are still thousands of warheads, but it's not any longer these huge amounts that were there during the Cold War. Especially the US and Russia have greatly reduced their arsenals. And, you know, for decades, World War III has not happened in the Cold War. I think now that is also used as a scarecrow by Russia, because many people have forgotten that we've already lived in these extremely dangerous times.
Or they have not just lived.
Yeah, or they're too young to remember. Or yeah, exactly. So so this is a psychological war, and unfortunately, one has to say it's successful. At least in Germany, I see it with many ordinary people. They are really afraid of World War III now, and you see in local newspapers they discussing bunkers and the state of the bunkers and where they are, and you know where to hide if World War III happens. But, you know, I don't think that is really, this is all about World War III. I think it's more about the stability of the Russian political regime. This is much more about domestic Russian affairs than about really some sort of apocalyptic confrontation between Russia and the West.
Andreas Sumlund, an analyst of the Stockholm Center for Eastern European Studies. He is now the guest of the Ukraine Calling radio show on Hromadske Radio. And since you mentioned Germany, many people here in Ukraine and in some other countries think that Germany is probably one of the staunchest, no, I would not say allies of the Putin regime, but one of the countries where the illusions about Russia, which you mentioned earlier, are most prolific. Is it really so, or is this just an impression that we get because we do not know Germany as well as we should?
When I speak about this in Germany, I'm usually very critical about German foreign affairs and also the cooperation with Ukraine and the insufficient sanctions against Russia. But here I would rather like to defend Germany in the sense that since 24th of February, we have really seen a paradigmatic change in the German thinking about Eastern Europe. So earlier, after the annexation of Crimea, there was already a change, but there was still then this illusion that by cooperating with Russia, Russian imperialism can somehow be contained. And there was this interdependence theory and the idea that through economic rapprochement, we would also be then politically, that would also moderate the Russian regime politically. And that has now obviously failed, this policy. And now we have actually a change both in the political elite and even in the population among ordinary people. The change in public opinion is actually quite stunning. If you look at the first month of this year and then in spring, there is a almost diametrical change, for instance, concerning delivery of weapons. There's still a discussion now against this threat of World War III about heavy weapons in Germany. There's a divided public opinion, but that is not even that I would sort of partly defend this divided public opinion because it's not informed by some sort of sympathy for Russia or for Putin, but it's rather determined by this fear of World War III. And some people are more fearful. They don't want Germany to send too many heavy weapons to Ukraine, and others are less fearful, and they usually then support more resolute help. So I think there is now a rather fundamental change, and the many problems that we see with German delivery of weapons and fulfilling all of its promises that the German government has made over the last 5 months. The main problem here is implementation and a lack of experience in doing that. So Germany usually has the image of being a highly effective and powerful country, but we are not very powerful and effective in military terms. This is also in conducting geopolitical conflicts. This is not something that we have usually done in the past. We are very good in cultural exchange, in developmental help, in economic cooperation, in scientific cooperation. These are our classical fields of foreign policy, but military technological cooperation with heavy weapons is something new to us. And that's why it's going very slow, contradictory, back and forth. But that is, I would say, more sort of a practical issue than an ideological issue. I think the ideology has actually changed the foreign policy doctrine quite fundamentally.
You still say we when talking about Germany. You spent so much time in Ukraine that you must have gone native in some aspects at least. And you work for the Stockholm Center, so you are a bit Swedish, I presume. But do you feel yourself a European, a German, a Ukrainian? And by the way, the issue of Ukrainian identity, how do you treat it?
Well, myself, I don't see much contradiction in feeling myself affiliated to different identities and nations. And indeed, I think my main sympathies are now with Ukraine. I've lived here 20 years. Kyiv is actually the city in the world where I've spent relatively most of the time. I've never lived longer in any other city, neither in Germany nor elsewhere. than in Kyiv. So I feel very much attached to Kyiv and Ukraine. Yeah, Ukrainian national identity is now, I think, finally, I would say, complete. There is a saying, a very cynical saying in political science, which goes like, not only do nations make wars, but also wars make nations. Yeah. And so this is the result now of this war, this unification of geopolitical outlooks, and the identity issue seems to me largely solved now, has been largely solved in the last 5 years. Already, it has been pushed already in 2014. Then there was this push towards a sort of national unification. But even before that, I mean, there was always this discussion in the West that I never understood about the allegedly divided Ukraine. Most countries are divided in one way or another. You know, in Germany, the West and East is divided, and maybe even the deeper divide is between the North and the Protestant North and the Catholic South. Italy is divided, Poland is divided, Great Britain is divided. So this is actually, yes, there was division, which has now, and there's now much less in Ukraine, but that is not so unusual, actually, for many countries. And there are actually other countries, like, let's say, Belgium, which are much more divided than Ukraine ever was. So that was always this discussion about the sort of incomplete national identity of Ukraine was always somewhat artificial, I thought. But now the issue is basically gone. I think there's a very small minority now left in Ukraine that sort of is still not attached to the Ukrainian state.
Wars make nations, an apt phrase, of course, but this suggests that nations are being made around resistance and around something that they perceive negatively. What is the positive thing that may unite or unites Ukrainians from your point of view, Andreas?
I think national identity is something good, but I would still think that national identity is something, as a famous scholar has once said, nations are imagined communities. So it's a matter of construction. You can use whatever you want as a sort of unifying idea. Obviously, the major issue is always literature and language. That is, of course, perhaps the most unifying issue. And then historical discourse is more complicated. And here, not only domestic, but also foreign affairs plays a role. So what we know from opinion polls is that the Holodomor has always been something unifying in Ukraine identity since the 1990s already, when basically the literature became popular about became read about the Holodomor. Other issues are more contentious, but that is also not so unusual. So that is also present in other nations. I guess the positive, main positive issue is, of course, Ukrainian culture, not only literature, but also other forms of culture and the history. And again, I wouldn't comment on that much, because that is basically, the history is rich, the literature is rich, the culture is rich, and whatever then becomes more important, I'm not even sure that it can be regulated in any way. That is something maybe spontaneous, what then people are most united by.
Coming back to what you have said, Andreas, I may be mistaken, but I thought that I heard the word imperialism leaving your lips. Are you a Marxist?
No, I'm not a Marxist. Also, I'm also not an anti-Marxist. I think, you know, Marxism can sometimes be useful. But imperialism is not necessarily a Marxist term. I think it's something that is the main pathology of Russian political culture, as it was for a long time of German political culture. The idea that, you know, you should rule territories outside your nation, that is something that is unfortunately still an issue here in the post-Soviet space. So for Germany, I think that's gone, fortunately, but not for Russia.
Mm-hmm. So, Andreas Umland, an analyst at the Stockholm Center for Eastern European Studies, is not a Marxist, But sometimes I read allegations that you are a Nazi. Mm-hmm. And this is to my mind because you're trying to be objective and unbiased, but other people, in the fact of your trying to be unbiased, see your bias. Would you defend yourself in this respect?
No, I mean, what often is the issue here is that there is a certain part of, I don't want to discuss the Russian discourse. I think that's actually not worth discussing much. But what often happens in the West is that left-wing researchers, they have recently taken an interest in Ukrainian ultranationalism, both historic and contemporary ultranationalism, which did exist and does exist. So I'm not denying that. The problem that I often have then in communicating with journalists or researchers about that is, and the same goes for my colleagues like Anton Chekhovtsov or Vyacheslav Lihachev or Ivan Gomza, we are commenting much on this, is that we come from comparative right-wing extremism studies. So all of us have studied other forms of right-wing extremism first. Let's say Gomza, French ultranationalism, or Anton Chekhovtsov, West European ultranationalism, Lihachev and myself, Russian ultranationalism. And then we've come to study Ukrainian ultranationalism. And then we see that it's something that is present and that is perhaps also a problem, but that is, in comparison to other countries, it's actually minor. It's actually less than you would expect in terms, for instance, of the electoral support, the strength of the parties, the presence in the Verkhovna Rada. It's actually, in all of these regards, and also regarding violence against, let's say, LGBT, Roma, and so on, which does exist. You know, all of this does exist, and I think the electoral support that the far right still gets is too much, like it's too much in many other countries, but it's relatively less. And when I'm arguing this, then people think that I'm sort of have sympathies for that, or that I'm sort of defending that. But now we have actually the result of many of these warnings in the West also, where I think many journalists have actually supported this this Russian discourse that there is allegedly here in Ukraine some sort of major threat. And the problem with these Western comments was then often that they were retranslated into Russian. And then these Western concerned anti-fascists, they become then suddenly witnesses for Russian propaganda, where the Russian propaganda says it's not only us which is saying that there was a fascist coup in Ukraine and ultranationalism, fascism is a major problem in Ukraine, but it's also these researchers, and they're Western researchers, they're Western at Western universities, and so the so oddly many of these concerned anti-fascists in the West, they, because they see it out of proportion, they've become now unwillingly, certainly. They're not supporters often. Most of them are not supporters of Putin at all. They are actually anti-Putinists, anti-fascists, anti-ultranationalists, anti-imperialists, and so on. But they've become, with their alarmist discourse about Ukrainian ultranationalism, they've become then unwitting supporters of this Russian propaganda war.
Recently, I published a video sent to me by my relatives from London, UK, about a huge demonstration, a huge rally in support of Ukraine. And one of the people who answered or replied to this tweet said, what do they want? They want the UK government to flare up the war. This is not for the first time that I hear your opinion, this opinion, and you touched on this as well earlier in our conversation. So there's a concerted effort, I think, by Russia, but also shared opinion among many Western Europeans that delivering arms to Ukraine, and then you can continue delivering financial support or any other support, of course, makes us stronger, but at the same time, it prolongs the war. How can we counteract this? And One of the messages that Ukraine's been spreading since at least February this year was that Ukraine is now protecting democracy and peace in Europe and the entire world. We've heard this before, and many people here believe that this is so, but will Western Europeans or Americans ever share this point of view?
Yeah, it's a complicated issue. I'm actually somewhat hesitant to support this idea that, you know, if we don't stop Putin now in Ukraine, he's going to go to Berlin or something like that. That's, I think, overdrawn, and that doesn't fly in Germany. I think there's no immediate threat of this. But something I've been arguing, for instance, is that, well, if you now, there's also this discussion about a ceasefire and so on. If you now give Putin a ceasefire, yeah, and then the troops are not going to be employed in Ukraine anymore. Putin has recently mentioned, when he compared himself to Peter the Great, the city of Narva. What happens then if Russia then redeploys the troops that are currently in Ukraine to the Russian-Estonian border and tries to reconquer, as Russians would put it, Narva, which makes totally sense from a Russian point of view, because Narva is the most Russian city outside Russia. It's most Russian, more Russian actually than Sevastopol in terms of the percentage of citizens of Narva that are ethnic Russians, and also in terms of the percentage of Russian speakers in Narva.
Yeah, I've been there once. I was totally surprised that I saw only some official signs in Estonian language, and I watched local television, and they were all speaking Russian, although they did not express some separatist or irredentist ideas at that time. But still, this was very, very unusual in Estonia, where you see a total different situation in other places.
Yeah, and then, of course, you know, most people will know that, but one would have to add that Narva is on the territory of NATO and the European Union. And then, actually, Article 5 comes in, the EU treaty article, I think, was it 23.7, something like that, also. So the European Union is also a defense union, is also obliged to help each member country to defend itself. And then we have actually World War III. And once you tell it that way, perhaps maybe that then is understood. Also about the weapons deliveries. I mean, the question is not only tactical today, that Ukraine needs today the heavy weapons, but the question is also, if we ever come to a ceasefire, what is actually going to happen then? I'm afraid Ukraine is not going to enter soon either NATO or the EU. Ukraine is probably not going to get any other military alliances. It may get some sort of security guarantees again, but, you know, Ukraine already had experiences with such security guarantees. So there's nothing actually on the table here for Ukraine. The only way for Ukraine to survive the next years is to arm itself, or to be armed by its Western allies or other non-Western allies. And so Ukraine needs these heavy weapons anyway. It's not just for the war now. It's maybe even Ukraine even needs the weapons more for peace, to preserve then the peace once we have achieved it. Yeah, but that is something that is a kind of a way of thinking that is actually difficult to grasp for many Germans. Unfortunately, that's not the way they think. They want to have some sort of, you know, agreement with Russia, and then we sign something, and then, you know, we sort of come to a common understanding. This is the sort of world that, unfortunately, many still live in. They are very skeptical now of Putin, but they still don't understand how you deal with such a situation.
Andreas Umland, an analyst and scientist, he works now for the Stockholm Center for Eastern European Studies, but he's also a prolific writer on social networks. Why you, who is always paid attention as a scientist and analyst, and whose works are being critiqued in both positive and negative way by your colleagues, why do you resort to social networks?
Well, you know, that's my understanding of what we as academics are for. You know, I think, with, especially with political scientists, if you are not, I wonder why you would be a political scientist if you are not also somehow trying to eventually influence politics in a, maybe in a very indirect way. But if you just do political analysis and then publish, sometimes something is in an obscure academic journal, I mean, that is a, you can have a certain cognitive satisfaction from that. But usually, I would think most political scientists, they would not enter the profession with such a from such a motivation. Because if you are pure scientist, I mean, why not go then into physics or astronomy or mathematics or you know, and then you can live in this sort of parallel world of academia. So as political scientists, I think we are also political. We are not just studying politicals. We are politics. We are, by definition, almost also involved in political affairs. And here, I mean, social media is just one of the instruments that we've recently received. Before it was journalism mainly, or you go into politics actually yourself. That's actually my, some of my colleagues do that. They go into parties, they go into parliament, and so on. But then the problem is then if you do that, if you go this way, then you, you can't do much research actually anymore. But whereas the sort of journalism, social media activity plus research is still something possible.
Out of the huge number of your academic articles and your social networks posts, which ones to your assessment have made the biggest impact?
Yeah. Good, good question. Well, usually it's, unfortunately, one has to say in a way, it's usually English language publications because that's most widely than read. And then, there is a certain ranking then of the outlets. Foreign Policy, for instance, is somewhere where I've, it's a journal or a website where I've published before. In the social networks, I'm actually now surprised in the last months, I would say, how important LinkedIn in my perception has become. Otherwise, it would be Twitter, of course, but LinkedIn is now also something that has become more prolific in my perception, at least. Facebook is actually not that important. So when I'm posting something on Facebook, actually the responses are limited and often, and the most feedback you get usually on LinkedIn and Twitter.
And the message that you were able to promote, the most important message from your point of view that met with, if not approval, then acceptance from your audience?
Well, the last months were just, I was an organizer or co-organizer of a number of so-called open letters, of which is actually somewhat secretarial work often because you have to write a lot of emails to organize them. And that has had some impact. We've written before the war with colleagues, mainly in East European studies and security studies, warning about the coming war. And after the start of the war, we called for weapons deliveries. A couple of weeks ago, we've published a counter letter to a German open letter that was calling for, that was called Ceasefire Now, and published by German intellectuals who are afraid of World War III and therefore advised the German government to promote a ceasefire between Ukraine and Russia. And our counter letter was called Heavy Weapons Now. And so that is often a rather, actually, as I said, secretarial work, because you have to write a lot of emails to get everybody on board and the information and then to find somewhere to publish it. Otherwise, we in this Stockholm Center for Eastern European Studies, I think we are relatively new, just slightly more than a year old, and we are trying to influence the Western debate in a way so as to remind, so to say, the West of its own values.
By the way, will you define Eastern Europe for me and our listeners and the West as well?
Yeah, I mean, that is now a difficult question, actually. But you could argue that Ukraine is actually part of the West. I mean, the odd thing is that sometimes the East European or Central East European countries, they are more Western in their culture now that, at least in my perception, that some of the classical sort of West European countries, which have become sort of fishy in terms of defending liberalism, independence, human rights, and so on. But in Sweden, I think far more than in continental Europe, there is a better understanding of these sort of core Western values. And it's a little bit, I would say, even perhaps a mission of our center to remind our colleagues about what that means in the policies of the European Union, of NATO, of nation states of Europe vis-a-vis Russia. And also vis-a-vis the countries that need help, like Ukraine, Moldova, Georgia especially.
Before we'll come to the questions which will be rounding off this conversation with Andreas Umland of the Stockholm Center for Eastern European Studies, a question about the language. We are talking English now. There is a clash of Ukrainian and German accents on air. But still, we are talking English. And I have thought for quite some time that in Ukraine we pay too much attention and too much significance explaining ourselves in the English language at the expense of other European and world languages. Is it right to talk to Germans, Spaniards, and French in English? And I mean the general attitude. Does the German or Polish or Italian audience get the messages in a language that is still foreign to them?
Well, my impression is that for the smaller countries, English is actually fine. Like for Sweden, for instance. I mean, also if you look at the. At the data about, you know, how many English speakers you have then in these smaller or the Netherlands or countries like that, there I think English is actually fine. But for the other countries, of course, communication in good quality, German, French, Italian, and so on, and perhaps even more important, Chinese, Japanese. So these are also, this is quite important. And then to get, often the issue is also to get into the right outlets, because in all of these countries you have these sort of Eastern Europe experts and expert outlets. Now you have also Ukraine-related outlets that have a lot of good information often on Ukraine, but that's not widely read. So the trick is actually, how do you get into a generic outlet? That's also what I see in a way as my sort of personal mission to get into not, I mean, for instance, there's a brilliant journal produced in Kharkov in Poland called New Eastern Europe by friends of mine, Adam Reichert and Iwona Reichert, who edit that. It's an excellent journal, but it's not my first choice. Sometimes I publish there as well, and I like them very much. But that's not quite the audience. It's actually to try to find the people, to reach the people who are not well informed, who have these sort of ambivalences, to reach them. This is the main trick. And sometimes that still doesn't work, because there are these echo chambers then that we sort of speak to ourselves, and that we don't reach people who don't have an immediate understanding and interest for a country like Ukraine.
Coming back to what we started actually our conversation from, I quoted your post about the Amnesty International statement on Ukrainian army's actions in this war. And since many people might have overlooked this topic, would you please explain why you felt that you should react to this?
Well, in fact, it's just a Twitter thread, and I think for most Ukrainians it will be quite trivial in terms of the content that I wrote about. But just for the sort of Western audience, I think it was important here to point out that Amnesty International has made here a judgment about tactical military decisions, and I'm not sure that actually Amnesty International is qualified to do so. It's not a military agency or think tank. And second, that an implication of this critique was somehow that the Ukrainian army, when it is posting its troops in residential areas close to civilian infrastructure, is somehow not enough worried about the sort of collateral damage that this can lead to. And that is, of course, a very grave accusation. And what is even worse, it's actually exactly what Russia has been saying over the last 8 years, that the Ukrainian state does not care about Ukrainian citizens. And that's actually the very justification of the war, that, you know, there are these Russian speakers that the Ukrainian army terrorizes somehow, and that's why Russia has invaded Ukraine, because it's so to say a responsibility to protect by Russia. Although we know that the pseudo civil war in Eastern Europe has been triggered by the Russian state, there is now actually very good research. There was earlier actually already good research by a historian called Nikolai Mitrokhin, a Russian historian who has researched that, and now there's also a very good study by a political scientist, German political scientist, Jakob Hauter, who has looked at the exact sequence of the escalation in April 2014, and he has shown, like Mitrokhin did before, that the Girkin group was in close contact with the Russian state at this time. So the Russian state has actually created this war, and is today actually sort of taking this pseudo-civil war as a justification for the large military invasion. And Amnesty International is actually with these sort of publications supporting this narrative. I think that it would have been fine if Amnesty had been communicating what it had found, not publicly to the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense. You know, that would have been entirely fine. You know, that's their job to do and to be critical. But to come publicly out with such a statement against the context, the background of the Russian justification for the entire war is actually very insensitive.
And finally, 5 or so months of the open phase of aggression, international solidarity, support for Ukraine in many foreign countries, and we start to hear about Ukraine fatigue. But many, many years of Andreas Ublandt's association with this country and articles and secretarial work for open letters and studies and all this kind of stuff. Where's your Ukraine fatigue?
No, I don't have any for Ukraine fatigue. On the contrary, I've now visited again Ukraine. I was actually by accident when the war broke out outside Ukraine, and I have family obligations in Germany, which is why I couldn't come here earlier. And for me, the main problem now with Ukraine is the logistics of traveling to Germany. So this is now actually become very inconvenient. No, I think, Ukraine needs even more support now than it used to be the case. So, and I hope that will also be so for other people. And actually, my impression is that we are not actually going into Ukraine fatigue, because what I see in Germany is that many people have now become interested, and they've become deeply interested. And so I think there's now a certain dynamism, and maybe I'm seeing it in a too rosy colors here, that will actually not let us get back to this earlier. This topic of Ukraine fatigue was mentioned many times before, basically during the last 30 years. I think we are actually out of this phase now. I think there will not be Ukraine fatigue.
Thank you. Andreas Umland of the Stockholm Center for Eastern European Studies. You've been listening to Ukraine Calling, a radio show at Hromadske Radio, Kyiv, Ukraine.